Welcome to Holden Village. Today, in the fabulous fireside room, the speaker is Christine Carlson, and she will be speaking on Romans, the creation. So, let's listen in on Christine.
For those of you who are new, welcome to Bible study. We are doing a series this week on community issues in Romans. We looked at sin, we looked at slavery, we looked at God's work, and today we're looking at the creation, and we'll be focusing a lot on material in Romans 8. So that's the place that you can turn to if you want to. But this is a series, a part of that. On Saturday, I know some of you are leaving today. A bunch of you have talked to me about that. Tomorrow we'll be looking at the ending of Romans. 12 through 15, but we'll be focusing primarily on chapters 14 and 15, and we'll be talking about the neighbor. So if you want to read those chapters, you could even look at them together if you're traveling out of here together. And the notion that we'll be looking at is Paul's sense of upbuilding the neighbor. Paul stresses this so much at the end of the book, that we live not for ourselves in our own interests, but to upbuild one another. It's the image of a household building up each other. And so that's just a little glimpse of what we'll be looking at tomorrow. 14 and 15. So you can take a look at that yourselves if you're not going to be here tomorrow. But today, then, we'll be focusing on the creation. I like to put an outline up every day for those of you who might not have been here before. Just so you can move into Romans with us. We've been working our way through the book, not looking at it every verse by verse, but picking out issues and looking at those. But just to briefly remind ourselves of the shape and structure of the book of Romans. Verses 1 to 7 are Paul's greeting. He identifies himself, Paul, and he identifies the people he's writing to all the beloved at Rome. Then there's a thanksgiving. I thank my God for you. Paul is very grateful for these people. And then the theme of the letter, the gospel is the power of God for salvation. And then verses 1:18 to 3:20, that's where we looked at sin. And then the bulk of the letter, chapter 3, verse 21 through chapter 11, is where we've spent the last sessions. We looked at slavery, at God's word. And now today we're looking at the creation. Then Paul concludes the letter with implications for the community of believers, ethical implications then for all these things that he's talked about. And this is where our discussion of the neighbor comes in. And then Paul finishes off the letter with his own travel plans for the future and personal greetings too, that we looked at yesterday in the 16th chapter of Romans. Just lots of greetings to lots of people. So our session for today, focusing on the creation, will look a lot at Romans 8. So let's turn to that, and then we can get started here. We've talked about all the new things that come up in Romans 8. It's a fascinating chapter that way. We talked about how we would read Romans chapters 1 through 7, and we were talked about as slaves to sin, slaves to God. And then finally in chapter 8, verse 14, Paul for the first time talks about us as children. Even not only children, but heirs of God with Christ. And we talked about the drama of that new thing happening in Romans 8. We talked also about how we didn't speak in the letter to the Romans in chapters 1 through 7. No speech on our part. But when we're named children, then, in verse 14, we are given the gift of speech, addressing God as Abba. And we talked also, again, of the drama of that moment in this letter. We talked also about the Spirit, how the Spirit is not a real active character in Paul's letter. But finally, in chapter 8, the Spirit becomes a very prominent figure in this chapter. And it's through the work of the Spirit that God makes us children and gives us the gift of speech. So the importance of the Spirit for us here. And then Now we come to another new thing that, several new things that I want to look at today. The creation is another new thing that Paul introduces in the eighth chapter. Paul talks in the first chapter using words related to the creation. He talks about the creation of the world in chapter 1. He also talks about, and we looked at these verses, about how when we sin, we serve the creature rather than the creator. It was another time Paul used a related word to the creation. But the creation as a subject doesn't appear until Romans 8. Up to this point, Paul has been discussing things on the human scale. And then in Romans 8, starting with verse 18, we find the creation introduced for the first time. So that's some of the background leading up to this verse. Let's read verse 18 and then talk about that. I consider that the sufferings of this present time are not worth comparing with the glory about to be revealed to us. In verse 18, Paul talks about two concepts, the present time, which is a time of suffering, and the coming glory, which is about to be revealed to us. The Greek could also be translated to be revealed in us. The coming glory to be revealed in us. These two things, and as we read those verses, we're thinking of them again on the human scale. We are in the present time, in sufferings. We are awaiting the coming glory, the revelation of God. And then in verse 19, Paul just expands our sense of who's involved with this just enormously and magnificently when he introduces the creation. He writes in verse 19, "For the creation waits with eager longing for the revealing of the children of God." And as the creation is introduced, we realize that it's not only people, not only the human community that's in the present time and suffering and eagerly awaiting the coming glory. It's also the creation. The creation, too, is waiting, suffering in the present time, and waiting for the coming glory. And why is the creation waiting for this? Paul goes on to tell us in verses 20 and 21, "For the creation was subjected to futility, not of its own will, but by the will of the one who subjected it, in hope that the creation itself will be set free from its bondage to decay and will obtain the freedom of the glory of the children of God." What Paul tells us is that the future of the creation is all wrapped up in our future. We are not separate from one another, the human world and the creation. We are bound up with one another. And in fact, we're bound up in a way that the creation depends on us. The creation is enslaved in bondage, Paul says, and the creation will not be freed until we are freed as children of God. So that's why the creation is waiting for the work of God to be accomplished, because its freedom depends on our freedom. That's the kind of relationship that Paul sets up here between the creation and us. So, going on into verse 22. As the creation waits then, as we wait for the revelation of God, what are we doing? What is this present time like? Here's verse 22, where Paul goes on to talk about more about the creation. "We know," Paul writes, "that the whole creation has been groaning in labor pains until now." I'd like to retranslate that verse in light of what we looked at yesterday. Remember, yesterday we were looking at all of these words in the eighth chapter of the book of Romans that begin with ko. We talked about how up to this point in the letter to the Romans, this one isn't working very well. Here, ko. This little word ko that we use in English appeared 9 times in 7 chapters. Not so significant. But now in the 8th chapter, we talk about how this word appears 10 times in 14 verses, that there's this cluster of these co-words. And we talked about how this means with, and it's talking about how God works with and how God works in witness, we talked about. God works in community. That's what these co-words were stressing to us. And this verse 22 in chapter 8 contains two of those co-words. And I'd like to retranslate it this way. For we know that the whole creation is co-groaning and co-laboring until now. That's as close as I can get in English to the sense of the Greek. And my English translation doesn't capture that. My English translation says, we know that the whole creation has been groaning in labor pains until now. Do you have other translations that work with this?
Groaning and travail together until now.
Okay, which translation is that?
RSV, I think.
Okay, so they got the together sense. The RSV had that, but the new RSV dropped that. You know, that's interesting, because this co-word in Greek is very much wanting to emphasize that together sense, that we are laboring and groaning together, that the creation is doing this together. So that's a better translation in some ways. But what I want to do in this session is to look at this word, co-labor. What does that mean when Paul writes that the creation is co-laboring? I'd like to help fill that word out with some sense and meaning. Yeah.
It sounds to me like there is a single activity or goal. If you're doing it together, you must share a common direction.
Okay, if you're doing this together, you're all going together someplace. Yeah. Let's see. I think that's very much a part of what Paul is talking about, this together in labor and this sense of going someplace. Let's look at that word and see how this plays out as Paul is talking about it. This class today is maybe going to feel like a childbirth class, and I want to warn you about that. We're going to be talking about labor a lot. My generation, I know I've talked with my mother each time when I was having a baby. She would tell me, oh, you just do this so differently. When I had babies, nobody told me anything, and I just went into the hospital and had them. And my husband and I were going to childbirth classes and talking with each other about it. And when we had older children, we'd tell them everything, and this is just so different. Well, this is going to be more a my generation kind of class today. And we'll talk about the labor, the co-labor that Paul is discussing here. So I hope that's okay. I didn't ask you to bring your pillows or your breathing instructions, but it might start to feel that way a little bit. But this sense of co-laboring is important for us to consider, I think, because the creation, as Paul presents it, depends on us. The creation in labor is looking to us for something and looking to God for something. We're wrapped up in this together. So the creation's co-labor matters to us, and it's important for us to understand. The other thing is that as we go on in the 8th chapter of Paul, I think we get the sense that it's not only the creation that is co-groaning and co-laboring, but that we, the human community, are participating in that. Let's go on into verse 23. We read, and not only the creation is co-groaning and co-laboring, but we ourselves, who have the first fruits of the Spirit, groan inwardly while we wait for adoption. It's not only the creation that is groaning, but we are groaning. And I would suggest that we're laboring. We're groaning in labor, too, with the creation. And not only that, but as we go on into verse 26, we read about the Spirit again. Likewise, the Spirit, and we talked yesterday about how that next word is co-helps us. Likewise, the Spirit co-helps us in our weakness. For we do not know how to pray as we ought, but that very Spirit intercedes with sighs, my Bible says. That Greek word is groans, the same word used to talk about the creation and us. But that very Spirit intercedes with groans too deep for words. So the sense that we get here in Paul is not just of the creation co-groaning and co-laboring, but the human community joins that, and so does God through the Spirit. The creation, the human community, and God through the Spirit is all groaning and laboring together. So it's this huge cosmic labor that Paul is presenting here in the 8th chapter of Romans that just is enormous. So that's the what is laboring, and why I'd like to look at this image. You know, what does it mean for all of us all together to be laboring? How do we get a sense then of what this of this word? You know, how can we give meaning and fill this word in our imaginations? Co-laboring. One of the ways we could work through it, I think, is to look at our own experiences of labor. Listen to each other talk. What's that like? What's labor in childbirth like in our culture? That would fill that word with meaning for us. There's another way to go, I think, and it's this way that I would like to pursue with you together this morning. And that's to do a word study of co-laboring in the Bible, to see what sense of labor filled Paul and Paul's world as he was writing the book of Romans. How do they talk about labor in the Old Testament? That was Paul's scripture, just like it's ours. And what was the sense of labor, of God's involvement with labor in the Old Testament? The other place I want to look at just briefly is in the literature of Paul's time. How did they talk about labor together? So I'd like to take some minutes now and share with you some of the things I've found as I've investigated this word, labor, in the Old Testament, and the word co-labor in the literature of Paul's time, to see if that helps us get some understandings of it. One of the usefulnesses of a study like this, I think, is that it can act as a way to enlarge. We're not limited then to our own time and our own culture's sense of labor, but it can give us another sense of labor in another time. And you know, the way we think about it isn't the only way that people have ever thought about it in the world. And so maybe it can help us expand and understand new ways of laboring as we look at the Old Testament. So are there questions about how we're going to proceed for about the next 15, 20 minutes here? All right. Well, let's go then to the Old Testament and see what senses of labor we find there. The first thing I want to say to introduce this is that in Romans, the word that we find is co-labor, as I've been saying, co-laboring. This word with a co on it does not appear in the Old Testament. Paul is not drawing on a biblical word here as he writes. The word that we find in the Old Testament instead is labor. Not co-labor, but labor. And so that's the word that we'll look at in the Old Testament. What sense of labor in childbirth does the Old Testament have? This word, co-labor, comes from Greco-Roman literature. This is a Greek influence on Paul. So that's where he gets that word. So that's the introductory thing I wanted to say about that word. In the Old Testament, then, this word of laboring is used in a number of ways. but is also not used in some places. And I think that's another way to work your way into something. You see how it's used, but it's also interesting to see how it's not used, where you might expect to find it and it's not there, and then you wonder why. So I want to talk about two things that are interesting about laboring where it's not used. The word labor in the Old Testament is rarely used to talk about an actual childbirth. That's one of the first interesting things about it. There are other words in the Greek language that are used to talk about labor in childbirth. There's one place where it's used. 1 Samuel 4:19, and we'll look at this story in a little bit. It's a wonderful story of Eli's daughter-in-law having a baby. And that's about the only time it's used to talk about an actual present childbirth. Otherwise,
It is a word that means laboring and childbirth.
Right, it means laboring and childbirth.
Doing the labor of building a house or something.
No, that's right. It always means labor and childbirth. Thank you for clarifying that. And also I should clarify that the Old Testament that I'm working with to do this study is called the Septuagint, which is the Greek Old Testament, the one that Paul worked with. You sometimes see it abbreviated with the Roman numerals, LXX for 70. There's also the Bible, the Old Testament in Hebrew, and our translations, our English translations depend a lot on the Hebrew for their translations. The one I'll be using is the Greek Bible, and that's the translation that Paul used in his time. He was not reading the Hebrew Bible, but the Greek Bible, which is real interesting. The first thing about that word then, it's used always to talk about labor and childbirth, but it's rarely used to talk about an actual birth happening, just in 1 Samuel. The other place that it's used to talk about an actual birth is in Job, the third chapter, where it tells about the birth of wild goats. That's the other place. Otherwise, the uses of it are metaphoric. It talks about labor and childbirth, but in a metaphoric way. For instance, let's look at one of those just to give you an example of that. In Exodus chapter 15, verse 14. The children of Israel have just been delivered from Egypt. They're safely on the other side, and Miriam sings her song, and Moses sings his song. And as he sings his song, Moses talks about the reaction of people of other countries to this mighty work of God delivering the children of Israel. And in Exodus 15:14, Moses says, "The peoples heard, they trembled. Pangs seized the inhabitants of Philistia." That word pangs is this word labor. Labor seized these people when they heard the mighty works of God to deliver the children of Israel. So women in labor are being compared to the enemies of the Israelites when they see the mighty hand of God at work. Another place where we find a metaphoric use is in Psalm 48. Psalm 48, verses 5 to 6. And here, the kings of other nations come to Jerusalem, and they see this city, Zion. And what happens? We read, "As soon as they saw it, they were astounded. They were in panic. They took to flight. Trembling took hold of them there. Pain as of a woman in labor," is what my translation says. These kings are compared to a woman in labor as they behold the city of Jerusalem. So those are some of the metaphoric uses, and we'll find out more of them. So this word is rarely used to tell about an actual labor in childbirth. It's used more in a metaphoric way. The second thing I want to say is that it rarely appears in accounts that stress the pain of childbirth, which is interesting. It's rarely talking about the pain of labor. One of the things that's interesting to me is that in Genesis 3, when the man and the woman have sinned in the garden, and God comes and says to the woman, "I will greatly multiply and increase your pain in childbirth," this word, labor, that we're looking at, is not the word used. That's one passage where if this word was primarily talking about the pain of childbirth, you'd expect it to be there, but a different word is used. So pain is not the main thing that can be in our imaginations as we approach this word in Romans 8:22. So if it doesn't tell about so much actual labor in childbirth or pain in childbirth, what does it tell about? Let's look at some of the positives here. The first thing I want to say is that this word labor that we're looking at tells about the strong work of women in labor. That's one of the first things I want to say about it. It tells about the strong work of a woman in labor in childbirth. We see this, for instance, in 2 Kings. 2 Kings 19:3. King Hezekiah is speaking, and he says in 2 Kings 19:3, "This day is a day of distress, of rebuke, and of disgrace. Children have come to the birth, and there is no strength to bring them forth." Do you see the sense there? Labor needs strength to make it happen, and if there's no strength, it's a failed labor, and this baby isn't going to be born, is what Hezekiah is saying here. Another place we see this is in the prophet Micah, chapter 4. And this is a really interesting passage, so if you want to turn to that, we can look at it briefly. In Micah, chapter 4. The daughter of Zion is the character here that Micah is talking about. And she is suffering great calamities, which have brought on her the pangs as of a woman in labor, Micah says. And this is kind of funny. You know, you don't expect to laugh when you're reading Micah 4, but it hit me funny. Here's the daughter of Zion is being portrayed as being in labor. And the Lord looks at her and says, "Be in labor." And, you know, there you are, in labor. And somebody's telling you to be in labor. It's an imperative verb that's used there. And then the Lord goes on to say, "And strengthen yourself." And the Hebrew Bible doesn't use that word. My Bible says, "Writhe and groan, O daughter of Zion." The Greek Bible says, "Be in labor, O daughter of Zion, and strengthen thyself." And that's another time when I laughed when I was reading Micah and encountered this. The word in Greek for strengthen thyself is andrizu. And maybe you can see in here a root that you'll recognize. My second son is named Anders. A-N-D-E-R-S. Do you see A-N-D-E-R sort of in there? These are both mean man. The name Andrew also is from the Greek and means man. And you thought my son had a Norwegian name. It's a Greek name and means man. And what the Lord says to the daughter of Zion is, "Be in labor," and as it's often translated, it says, "Strengthen thyself." What God really says is, "Be a man." Become a man is what this word is in the Greek. And that was real interesting to me, that to a woman in labor, you'd say, "Be a man." Be like a man. And so I can understand why they've translated that, strengthen thyself. You know, it's kind of a sexist image, or it is a sexist image, and what sense is there to make of that? So strengthen thyself seems like a good translation of that. But as I thought about it, that seemed unfortunate in some ways to me, because the sense that you get here is that labor is an event in which a woman can be extraordinarily strong. Stronger than her gender usually is. Be like a man, you know. Stronger than her gender usually is, or is thought of as being. Labor is the kind of event that demands that kind of strength, and a woman of strength. And that's the promise of the Lord to the daughter of Zion in this passage in Micah, that you need incredible strength, God is saying to the daughter of Zion, and I will give that to you so that you can labor and birth. That's the sense here. So this word labor tells about the strong work of a woman in labor. It also tells about the rich and complex emotions of labor. I think sometimes we think about labor as a purely physical event, you know. These things happen in your body and this stuff happens. And looked at it from a physical point of view. It always caught me by surprise in a way with each of my labors, how complex they were with many emotions, rich and complex emotional times. And there's a story in 1 Samuel 4:19, and I've got that written up here, that tells this so well, I think. So let's turn to that, 1 Samuel 4:19. And look at that story. While you're finding it, I'll fill you in on the background of it. In 1 Samuel 4, it tells the story of a war. Israel is at war with the Philistines. They have a first battle, and 4,000 Israelites are killed. They lose the battle. So they stop fighting, the Israelites regroup, and they say, well, what should we do? We need to do something here. So they decide that they're going to Shiloh to get the Ark of God and bring that to the battlefield where they will encounter the Philistines again. In Shiloh, Eli is the 99-year-old priest who stays with the Ark of God. He's too old to go to battle. So his two sons, Phinehas and Hophni, come with the Ark of God. They have another battle with the Philistines, with the Ark of God present, that should have protected them and gotten them the victory. Instead, this time, 30,000 Israelites are killed. They lose the battle just horrendously. Word then is brought back to Eli, old Eli, back in Shiloh. The messenger tells him that his sons are both killed. Both Phinehas and Hophni are dead. The Israelites have lost the battle, and the Philistines have captured the Ark of God. When Eli hears that news, he falls over dead. Then we read in verse 19, now his daughter-in-law, the wife of Phinehas, was pregnant, about to give birth. When she heard the news that the Ark of God was captured and that her father-in-law and her husband were dead, she wept and gave birth. And you see the complexity and the richness of her labor there. It involves issues of religion and state. The Ark of God has been captured. Israel, her country, has been defeated. And Eli, the temple priest, has died. Issues of family. Her father-in-law, her husband, and her brother-in-law have all died or been killed. Issues of faith. The Ark of God did not protect the Israelites from defeat. And issues of her own grief. She weeps as she begins her labor. All of these complex, rich, difficult issues are it's the sphere in which she labors. And not only does she labor in them, but when she gives birth to a son, she names him Ichabod. Meaning, we read on in verse 21, the glory has departed from Israel because the ark of God had been captured and because of her father-in-law and her husband. All these issues are there not only in her labor, but in the child that results from her labor. And she names him for all of them.
In my version here, it says in 20, at about the time of her death, the woman that stood by her said to her, "For that, for thou hast born a son."
Right.
Do they mean by death? Do they mean?
Yeah, it's ambiguous whether she dies or not. The Greek says at the point of her death, these women say to her, "Fear not, you have given birth to a son." And does that life bring her back from death, or does she die? It's ambiguous here. It's ambiguous here. But you bring up the next point, which this story shows very well, the closeness of labor and death. And actually, labor in the Old Testament is often used to talk about death. We see it here in this story. Oh, I wish I didn't have to vacuum right now. Can you still hear me, or is it hard to hear? Okay, raise your hand if you can't, and I can holler louder. But labor and death are often very close with each other and used to talk about each other in the Old Testament. In Psalm 18:4, we won't take time to look that up, but Psalm 18:4, for instance, the psalmist says, "The pangs of death encompassed me. The labor in childbirth of death encompassed me." Here, death and labor are just beside each other and telling about each other, suggesting that the work of dying is a lot like the work of birthing. They're very close. Also reminding us that when you're in labor to birth, you are facing the possibility of laboring to die. That's there. And I think in our country, modern obstetrics has taken away some of that sense. But in ancient Israel, a woman labored every time with death as a close companion. And will this result in birth or death was a question each time in ancient Israel. The last one I wanted to look at is the fact that in the Old Testament, men going into battle are often compared to women in labor. That's a real common comparison. And we find one in Jeremiah 29, and I won't take time to look this up with you, but I will talk about it. The Lord is devising a plan against the enemies of Israel, people called Idumea. And it says, "The Lord will spread his wings over their strongholds, and the heart of the mighty men of Idumea shall be in that day as the heart of a woman in her labor." So how do we read this comparison? The mighty men of Idumea going into battle, their hearts are being compared to the heart of a woman in labor. Is this a belittling comparison? Are their hearts weak and scared as they enter into battle? Is it a belittling and shaming thing to compare them to a woman in labor? That's a possible way to read that. But working with these comparisons in the Old Testament, the sense is much more, I think, that the hearts of the mighty men of Idumea facing battle are like the heart of a woman in labor in other ways. They both experience fear and anguish. They both are facing a great power coming upon them. The mighty men of Idumea are facing the power of the Lord, and a woman in labor is facing labor and childbirth. They both also are facing the possibility of death. Will this battle result in victory or death? The outcome is unknown. Will this woman birthing die? Will her child die? Or will they live? The outcome is unknown. So it's in these ways that a woman in labor and men going into battle are being compared with one another. And both of them need great strength to face what's ahead, is the sense. Finally, the this word labor in the Old Testament at times contains promise with it. Often it's used just to talk about the labor of childbirth. But there are times when the promise of life, the birth that's going to come, is in the word. And the one I want to look at is Isaiah 66, the last book of the last chapter of the book of Isaiah. Isaiah 66. And here we find Jerusalem in labor. And this is interesting. In Isaiah 66, verse starting in verse 7. We find Jerusalem, the city, the people of God, in labor. And we read in verse 7, before she was in labor, she gave birth. Isaiah, the end of Isaiah is full of the new things that God is doing. And here's God's new idea, which some of us might think is a good one. No labor, just a birth. And this is so interesting, I think, to think of in light of Genesis 3, where even in the garden, God greatly multiplied and increased the woman's labor. Even in the garden, there was some labor. And after the sin, that labor was greatly increased and multiplied. But here in Isaiah, God is doing an absolutely new thing. No labor at all, just a birth. And that's what's happened here in Jerusalem. Before her pain came upon her, she delivered a son. Who has heard of such a thing, says the prophet? No one has, not even in the garden before the fall. This is a brand new thing that God is doing. And so there's this promise of no labor, and then the promise of birth, and of God's work as the creator to do this. In verse 9, the prophet says, "Shall I open the womb and not deliver, says the Lord? Shall I, the one who delivers, shut the womb, says your God?" God is reminding us, I am the creator, and I can do this new thing because I made you. I gave you labor, and now I can give you no labor and just a birth. That's the kind of promise that's here. And not only that, but going on, we find in verses 10 and 11 that we're encouraged, "Rejoice with Jerusalem and be glad for her, all you who love her. Rejoice with her in joy, all you who mourn over her, that you may nurse and be satisfied from her consoling breast." We're pictured here as nursing babes being fed with this life from Jerusalem. It's real interesting imagery that we find here. So these are the things that I wanted to raise with a sense of labor in the Old Testament. It's usually not identified with pain, although that's there, but it's not used for that purpose. It tells of the strong work of labor. It tells of the rich and complex emotions of labor. It tells of the closeness of birth and death and of their similarity. It tells of the corporate sense of birthing, that this is done together. It's the people of Israel, the people of Idumea, the people of Philistia doing this together. It tells of the great of a great power coming down upon a woman in labor, of people at war, and the strength that you need to face that. And then it tells about the promise. There is birth, there is life. So those are some of the senses that we get in the Old Testament. And I think, for me, they've expanded my sense of this word. We don't, in our culture, talk about women in labor as great warriors. You know, we don't make that comparison. This isn't a comparison that we reach for much right now in our culture, comparing somebody to a woman in labor. But in the Old Testament, you can get the sense of how often this happened and of what it meant when they did. I'd like to go on then to just briefly say three things about the Greek sense of co-laboring. I talked about how this word co-labor. We've been looking at labor in the Old Testament. Of this word co-laboring, laboring together, is found in Greco-Roman literature. And I talked briefly about one of the instances, and this is all that I'll tell you about, in this play by Euripides called Helen, where this word appears. And this play tells about Helen of Troy, you know, who's abducted and taken off to Troy, and it's over her that the Trojan War is fought. And eventually in the play, Helen is recovered, and she's reunited with her husband Menelaus. Well, then at the moment in the play, their slave comes to them, and their slave says, you were so unhappy when Helen was abducted and taken away from you. But now you are happy again because you've been reunited. And the slave goes on, I want to co-labor with you. I want to co-feel with you in your happiness now. But I can't because I'm a slave, he says. Only a free person can co-labor. And so, says the slave, I'm going to say that my heart is free. And with my free heart, I will co-feel, co-labor with you. So the things I want to pull out of that instance are that co-laboring is not something that slaves were thought of as being able to do in Paul's time, only free people. Secondly, it is an emotional relationship. The slave wants to feel intimately with Menelaus and Helen at their pain and at their joy. It's an emotional relationship, not just a physical thing. And then it's what free friends do with each other. So with all this stuff laid out there, what can we say about it? What observations can we make? I've talked a lot here now. Are there things that, reflections that you'd want to make on what we've laid out as we think about labor and co-laboring and the creation and the human community and God doing this all together? Are there observations you would want to make about it?
I was a nurse who worked in the labor delivery rooms. The time of childbirth, at that very moment, that's the quietest time in the delivery room. There's that expectation, and it happens every time. There's that all of a sudden silence and that expectation before that child is actually delivered. It's amazing. It happens. It just happens every time.
Is that right?
It's a quiet expectation time. No matter whether there's one person there or the...
Whole group.
Huh. Huh.
You mean that the doctors don't talk?
No, they really don't. No, it's a sort of a... It's just a sort of a stop-off. It's amazing that everybody's just... They're just ready. Yeah. And they'll say, here it is, you know, or something like that. But there's just that one point.
It's quiet.
It just was amazing that it happened.
Huh.
And, of course, those were warriors when I was in there. Many times there were no... The woman was delivered alone. Or a parent, or, you know, something like this. They didn't have the cooperation that my children had, you know, where they could do all this thing like you did.
Yeah.
But it was amazing that this happened.
Yeah.
It's a different time.
Yeah.
And I would add to that, I have spoken a little bit too. Each time it's still a miracle. I mean, you don't get used to it and say, oh, another baby. Yeah. Mom is awesome, I think.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
For us to see growth.
Okay.
That brings me to a question that I've had in my mind. In verse 19, the earnest expectation of the creature waiting for the manifestation of the sons of God, sounds to me like that also is describing a togetherness there, the labor, that the sons of God will expose themselves as sons of God for this manifestation of the sons of God. But I have been interested in thinking that this creation, the earth, the animals, the vegetation, everything, is that groaning too? Is that a wrong conception?
No. You raised two very fine points. Maybe all of you couldn't hear her. But she was talking about the togetherness of this labor. And that's very much the way Paul wants us to think about it. I think in our country, we think of so individually of labor. Even when I had babies, my husband was there, so it was a bit corporate that way. But it was, we're very individualistic in the way we talk about birth. And Paul is very much wanting this to be a corporate sense, a together sense. I just missed the second point. Could you remind me of what else you said?
Creation.
Oh, creation, yes.
Animals.
Mm-hmm. What does this word creation mean here? Who is co-groaning and co-laboring? And I think that we can think about the whole creation here. People have fussed over the meaning of this word. And many propose that it's everything, the creation is everything in the world except the human community. So it's animals, trees, sky, all the forces of nature. That is the creation. And so it's that, everything but the human element that is groaning and laboring together. And then we join that as we move on into verse 23. And not only the creation, Paul writes, but we ourselves too, as if the creation is separate from us. And then also God joins the labor through the Spirit.
The redemption of our body.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, Paul is working so much with this notion that what is physical and flesh and body is mortal and in bondage to decay. And God is going to redeem even that, the redemption of our bodies.
We haven't used the word hope at all.
Okay.
I think that's in a hope, joy, expectation.
Mm-hmm.
When you talk about creation laboring toward this, I think that's a very important word. And a woman in labor is strengthened by hope.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. That's right.
And the joy that is to come.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so aren't we strengthened in that here as a community of faith, waiting for
the birth? Yeah, the birth, absolutely. And it's the hope, and another word we can use is promise. That's the promise in which we labor too. Both of those things, I think. That there will be a birth and life. And I know I sure felt that the first time when I was in labor. I had never done it before, and it was a little vague to me. So I mean, I knew I was going to get a baby, but the second time around, I labored much more in hope because I had experienced the fullness of that, and the third time even more because I had these babies and held them and loved them to death, and so it just increased the hope in which I labored each time. But you're absolutely right, the promise of that, of the birth.
That's in the next verse when you read the 24.
Okay. Mm-hmm. For in hope we were saved, Paul writes. Now hope that is seen is not hope, for who hopes for what is seen? But if we hope for what we do not see, we haven't seen this birth yet, but we hope for it. And then we hope with patience, Paul writes. Yeah, yeah. Just in conclusion then, it's almost 10. I want to look at two other things, I guess, that I'd want to stress at the end here. There are two other words in this 22nd verse that we haven't really looked at yet. We know that the whole creation has been co-groaning and co-laboring, Paul writes, until now. And those words are interesting to me, until now. They mark a transition. And you can think about it, maybe one way is that this labor is going into transition. And if you've had a baby, maybe you really well remember transition. It's the hardest time, the most intense time of a labor often. the time when you are getting as close to the birth, but not actually having the birth. I mean, it's coming, and the turmoil of the birth is enormous often. The intensity of it. That's the sense that Paul is wanting to convey here with those words to us. It's not that we're in the beginning stages of labor, walking around, having a cup of coffee, stopping once in a while for a contraction. Those words signal to us that this labor is in its very intense time until now. And there's hope because there's a change, and transition is the hardest, but it's also the most hopeful because it signals the birth is soon. The birth is coming very soon. So that sense of this co-labor and co-groaning being in transition until now. The other thing that Paul stresses so much in contrast to the Old Testament material, in the Old Testament material, the way the promise of labor, the way hope of labor is always realized is through a birth. And that's the fulfillment of the promise, the fulfillment of the hope, a birth. But Paul wants to push it even further, I think. That yes, we're in labor, the creation, the human community, and God with us. But if this birth results in a death, even then there's hope and promise. And that's where I want to turn again to these last words of chapter 8, where Paul writes, "Who will separate us from the love of Christ? Will hardship or distress or persecution or famine or nakedness or peril or sword? No, in all these things we are more than conquerors through him who loved us. For I'm convinced that neither death nor life..."